hard. They pulled together and they did a lot of good things. Biggest surprise of the whole season was beating Michigan at Ann Arbor.
Yes, wasn't that great? Oh boy. So how's it going, guys? Sound good? Okay. Okay. Okay, we're set. Let me just date it here. Today is January 26, 1995, that's it.
There we are.
This is Barry Tyker from the Oral History Project. I'm at WHA Studios with Jim Mott, and we're here to talk about the history of sports at the university. Let's start right at the beginning and go back to the early years. When were sports first introduced at the university?
Well, Barry...
No, I'm sorry, you can't give...
Can't say that. Okay. Well, sports were introduced at the University of Wisconsin starting in 1870 with baseball being played on the campus. Now, I have no recollection as to how it was played, except that in that 1870 season, we beat Albion 24-13. Janesville had a club team down in Janesville, Wisconsin, the Janesville Mutuals, I believe it was. And the Badgers beat them for what was the state championship, you might say. One of the games was 41-40. And I just can't imagine baseball being played that loose compared to what we see in modern times. And then Janesville in a return game beat the Badgers 41-17. Despite all that firepower, you might say, the baseball interest waned in the next several years and it must have been played, but there was just brief accounts of one game in 71 and no games in 74 and 75. This is the 1800s now. Along with that, in 1874, crew was introduced, and I suspect these sports were moving from the east to the west, and there was some class rowing, and then tennis came along in 1885, and there was some track that people were interested in, and I mentioned tennis. Crew, baseball, those were the sports at that time. Now, getting down to football, there was some football alluded to in the Badger yearbooks as having started about 1883. And in 1888, there was a lineup listed for the Badgers, but whether they played any games is unknown because there's no record that we can find of that year, but we do know that they started in 1889 and played the Calumet Club in Milwaukee late in early part of November, mid-November. There's a team that didn't score a point. They got beat 27-0, and that was the Calumet Club, and then they played Beloit College at Beloit and lost 4-0. And in 1890, they played Whitewater, and they beat Whitewater 106-0. The other three games the Badgers lost, one of which significantly was to Minnesota, which has become a great rivalry down through the years. But on this day in 1890, Minnesota handed the Badgers probably their worst defeat ever, 63-0. And
when we're talking the early, let's go into a little bit about the early type of how football was played in those days. If you could explain very basically how the game was played then as being different from how it's played today.
All right. The field was different. It was 110 yards long. The ball was more suited for kicking. It was sort of like a soccer ball. The passing was about 20 yards away. And that was in about 1906, 1905, 1906. What they tried to do was open up the game to avoid injuries. And I think one of those years the flying wedge was eliminated and they started, a former Wisconsin player, Eddie Kokoms, really gets credit for being the innovator of the forward pass in 1906 over at Carroll College. And I should say when he was at St. Louis University, but they had done their pre-season practice at Carroll College, and they started throwing the ball around pretty well. Not you're restricted as to how far back you could go on the, I think, 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage. You couldn't run all the way around or drop way back and then throw the ball as they do in modern times. And I guess the thing that happened to popularize football on our campus was the advent of Pat O'Day, who came to the United States and the University of Wisconsin in 1896-97 because his brother Andy was the crew coach. And Pat made his mark right away by kicking some long field goals. Yes, I think in his whole career he had 32 field goals in his four-year career. And one of them was 62 yards, I think, against Northwestern. But he did it not always being set up, but he had the ability to run with the ball. And just about at the time that the opposition might be catching him, to tackle him, he'd throw the ball out and then kick it. And he had great accuracy while he was on the move, which, you know, we see in modern times some of these field goal kickers shank them to the left and shank them to the right from a stationary set. So, but he was a good punter. Yeah, we played out at Yale, I think, in 1897. It might have been 1899. But I think we beat Yale, and he showed him his prowess in kicking and punting, and another game against Minnesota, he punted. He was credited with a 100-yard punt, and you have to understand that's where the 110-yard field comes into. You can't visualize a punt from one goal line to the other goal line these days, although one of the Wisconsin players in 1952 jumping ahead and George O'Brien kicked a 96-yard punt down at Iowa. Now, I didn't see that, but I understand that you get a tremendous roll, but it went from, I think, our one-yard line down to Iowa's three-yard line. So those are certain things. The other 90-yard punt that I'm familiar with was Jim Bakken in 1959, or I shouldn't say 59, it was 1961, at Northwestern, kicking from inside our 10-yard line, got credit for a 90-yard punt.
When O'Day came, I've heard stories about how he was discovered for the football team. Do you recall, have you heard those stories too?
Well, very, very briefly, because his brother Andy was here, I think he just wanted something to do. And he had been a football star in Australia. And if you've seen Australian rules football, there's a lot of kicking in the game, a lot of free kicks, a lot of kicking on the run. And so he was very adept at that. And I think when he got to Madison, there's no record of this, but it looked like his brother couldn't convince him to come out for crew. So he tried his hand at football and developed his art even more so than he had in Australia.
One of the interesting, there were all kinds of problems that revolved around these early sports, and one of the things I've read some articles on is professionalism, how some of these players, one player might line up for Wisconsin on 1 week, and 3 weeks later you might see him in the Michigan line playing against Wisconsin. Can you talk about that for just a little bit?
Well, there's, of course, the greatest incident of using an assumed name was by Jim Thorpe, who, before he won all of his medals in the 1912 Olympics, had played semi-pro baseball under an assumed name, which, after he wins the four gold medals in Sweden at the 1912 Olympics, people started saying, well, gee, you know, his picture's in the paper, and people that he played with says, I remember that guy, but his name wasn't Thorpe. And it did happen, and I think that was one of the things that led up to in the 1895 when the president of Purdue University decided to call together the people. He wanted to have a conference in Chicago of the schools that were involved to discuss things like this so that they could cleanse athletics from having that taint. And James Smart, the Purdue president, he called together his counterparts at Wisconsin, Northwestern, Minnesota, Michigan. Well, not Michigan in 1895. Michigan came in 1896 when they got together to form the Big Ten. Lake Forest College was there. And of course, there was the University of Chicago, University of Illinois, and Purdue. So there were seven schools at the time. Then in next year, in 96, when they got together and formed what has become the Big Ten, Michigan replaced Lake Forest. And then a couple of years later, 1899, Iowa and Indiana came into the league. And then in 1912, Ohio State came into the league. Now, what had happened, Michigan, there were some things done in 1906-07 that Michigan didn't like, so Michigan withdrew for a period of 10 years from the conference. So in all this time, the earliest you would have probably had the Big Ten was when Michigan came back in 1917 to rejoin the original members. But it went by that time the name of Western Conference, and then it went it was governed by the faculty representatives, and so I forget the exact title right now, but Conference of Faculty Representatives, I'll say, and we can check it out a little bit later. But that was the reason for getting together, was so that they could go over some of these things, you know, people playing for pay, and playing under assumed names. Those are some of the things that they talked about in which they wanted to make athletics pure. And so that's some of the background of forming the Big Ten.
The idea of faculty involvement, was that common in the country in athletics, or was that more or less a Big Ten feature?
I think at the time it was a Big Ten.
You have to give a little context.
Pardon?
You have to give just a little context on that. You said it was the Big Ten. Just say faculty.
Well, faculty participation in athletics. Excuse me.
No, I'm sorry. Could you just state that again, saying faculty representation in athletics was involved with Big Ten? Because you just answered my question, and people wouldn't have known what you were talking about.
Oh, well, faculty representatives, one from each school. Sort of lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Faculty conference of faculty representatives, one from each school, denoted that the faculty was interested in athletics, interested from the standpoint that it was going to be controlled by the faculty. There'd be faculty participation. There'd be various things passed by the faculty representatives that would become important. For instance, there's one instance there where they voted against having a training table. And we think that perhaps training table just came in the last 15, 20 years, but there was a training table established back then, and then they didn't have it any, they outlawed it, you might say. It was passed that they would get rid of it.
What is a training table?
Training table is where you have a meal after practice. Make sure that the athletes get good food to eat, and they don't go out and eat a lot of I don't know, in the 1890s, they probably didn't have fast food places, but they made sure they had good meals.
Let's talk a little bit about the facilities that these early, talk about football first, the facilities that would have been used, and also what kind of student support there was for football games in those early years.
Well, surprisingly, starting off with football, they played, some of the games were played on the lower campus, and we'd utilize across the, where the Memorial Union is in the armory. It was, no, we're going too far toward the lake. In between there, the two libraries, there was a field they called lower campus, and there were games played there. And then eventually we went to play at Camp Randall, which had been a state fairgrounds back in the, at that time, and earlier had been a training ground for our men going to fight in the Civil War. And it was called Camp Randall, and that's where the name Camp Randall evolves from. And we played there from about 1894 to 1915. There were some bleachers that collapsed, and there were some injuries, and this triggered a study to see if we needed a better stadium situation. And so it was deemed that, yes, they should build some permanent seats, which they started, and I think our first capacity was around 10,000 seats at Camp Randall, and our strategy ever after that was to, when the money became available, when we had a surplus, that we would add to the stadium, and you'll see it was built in stages, and the most recent stages, one in 1951 when they filled in the end zone and the north end zone. Then in 1957, at the end of the 57 season, they dug down right at the end of the season. They started taking out the, lowering the field by 10 feet. And that was ready to go for the 1958 season. And then in 1963, we had gotten back from the Rose Bowl game where we played 42-37 game against Southern California, but Ivan Williamson, our athletic director, had the feeling that Wisconsin football, on the basis of at that time, had come back strong and we were selling out. So they decided that we had a meeting in toward the end of January in 1963 to start planning for an addition to the stadium, which was the upper deck, and that was accomplished by the start of the 1966 season. And it was at the end of the 65 season that they started the construction so that we'd have it in time for the 66 season. And the permanent side where the offices are on the east side of the stadium, those were completed in the mid-1930s. So our capacity right up to the war, World War II, was about 45,000 people. And we had a whole string of sellouts when the people came back from World War II, and that's what triggered the expansion of the stadium at that time. Now, the armory, which is still here on campus, and which I remember as a student in 1947, them telling us that by the time we graduated, the armory would be no more. And now I think it's a national landmark, and I don't think it'll stay for posterity. But that was, in there was a swimming pool, 20-yard swimming pool, not much of a, not as big as the modern Olympic-sized pools that people are building even at the high schools these days. And there was a little annex to the armory where we had our indoor track meets, and those records will always stand as school records for that kind of a track. And that's where eventually we played basketball starting approximately in 1900, And we played basketball there and up until the field house was conceived and built and put into use in the 1930-31. The armory for most basketball, especially from the time that Walter Meanwell came to the university and started producing championship teams left and right, they always had a capacity crowd, which wasn't maybe 2,000, 2,300 people could get in there for a Big Ten game. And at the end of the, I think 1919 and maybe 1920 was the first year that we played the state high school boys basketball tournament in the armory. Prior to that, it had been played at Lawrence College under the sponsorship of Lawrence. And eventually, the normal schools, which are the state universities now, hosted the state tournament, used their facilities until they moved it to Madison, as I said, to start the night in 1920. And then when the field house was started to be utilized, of course, the state tournament for boys moved there. And, of course, starting in 1976, the girls' tournament's been played there, too. So the field house was built for about $500,000. It was the brainchild of George Little, who came to us from the University of Michigan, and for 2 years, 24 and 25, was he served in a dual capacity as the athletic director and the head football coach. But he had this vision that we should have a field house. And at one time, it was all set to go a little bit earlier, but the governor, Fred Zimmerman, vetoed the plans. That this would have been in late 25, early 1926. But we kept after it, and finally he got one approval from all the people that had to approve it. And they put it next to the stadium where it sits today. And they got that building for, as I mentioned, $500,000 approximately. And a lot of people didn't think that there was room for 8,000 seats. And a lot of people thought that's as much as we could go. And in fact, some people called it Little's Folly because they didn't believe that they'd ever fill it up. Well, we played Purdue in 34, 35, one of those years, and we had a capacity crowd. So they expanded it. They built the upper tiers there and made the capacity and approximately 13,000. But you'll find incidences like when we hosted the NCAA basketball championship meet in 1941 of 14,000 people in attendance. And there's also a picture that of Wisconsin boxing Washington State in 1940. And there's the caption on the picture says Wisconsin versus Washington State, gives the date in 1940, 16,000 people. So they did a lot of crowding. So that, and of course, but it was fortunate that George Little and that they would follow through. And when they saw the need to expand, they did expand. And fortunately for us, because another occasion right after the end of World War II, we had one of our best basketball teams, the 46-47 team that won the Big Ten championship. And there was so much interest in basketball at that time that we had to have series. We might play 12 home games, scheduled 12 home games. Well, one series saw six games and the other series saw the other six games. And that was about the only fair way you could do it. And so there was some great basketball played in 46-47. And then going back to the stadium, indoor track, as I mentioned, was in the Armory Annex. The outdoor track was inside the stadium. There was a running track around the stadium, which was used for our outdoor meets. And of course, you sat a little farther away from the field in those days then, because the track, there would be the football field and there'd be the track, and then would be the seats back here. And I remember in 1948, we hosted the Big Ten outdoor meet for the Big Ten, and it was the occasion of Tom Jones, our longtime track and cross-country coach, retiring. So we hosted that meet, and we did an excellent job. Competition was very good, and saw some great performances. And then eventually, after our digging down in the stadium in 1957, getting ready for 1958, we were without a track for a couple of years. And in 1960, we got an all-weather track out at by Guy Lohman Field, the baseball diamond, in the area where the present track and soccer complex is. Let's see, going back, baseball. Baseball was played behind the stadium. There are two diamonds that I remember. One was a little farther toward the mechanical engineering building, approximately just in front of where the nuclear engineering building sits now. And it was there in 1946 that I saw Robin Roberts pitch for the Michigan State against the Badgers. And there were we just sort of lined the baselines, and there was a tarp that was rolled up there, and you could sit on the tarp if you wanted. And so we saw, as I said, Robin Roberts pitch for Michigan State later. Well, I think he's a Hall of Famer now. The baseball diamond also was moved then right in back of the north end. And I remember in 1950, we played Notre Dame there, and we went 12 innings against Notre Dame, we only got three hits, but one of them was a home run by Bob Wilson in the 12th inning, and we won 2-1. And then for a couple of years, we played, then we played at Bree Stevens Field on the east side of Madison. It was there in 1950 that we beat Michigan in a doubleheader to win their last Big Ten championship, and we went on to play in the NCAAs. Then word came that they were going to build the Guy Lohman Field out on the intramural fields. And so for a couple of years, we played all over. Played at Middleton, played at Bree Stevens, and inaugurated Guy Lohman Field in 1952. Late in May, we played Michigan a doubleheader. We won one and lost one. If we'd won the second game, we would have, I think, tied for the Big Ten championship. And then we played at Guy Lohman Field through the early part of 1971, 72, in that time span. Then again, we went on the road then to play some of our schedules, because what they did was they took Guy Lohman Field from this side of the campus to the other side, out by, I forget what they call it. It's in back of Nielsen Tennis Stadium anyway. It's sort of a marshy area, and that's where we played baseball up until 1991, when the sport was dropped.
If we could go back for a moment, you gave us some really good examples of the early football scores, which were just outrageous, 4-0, and then 126 to 112 to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And you gave us some of these baseball scores that sound like football scores.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about some of the early basketball games? Because those sound more like what baseball scores would be like today, I think.
Well, basketball scores basically were pretty well contested games, and hard fought, and in most cases not very high scoring. And basketball emphasized a lot of defense, and we played, we toured the East one year, 1904, 1905, and the games were like 35-20, and I think that was the score that Columbia beat the Badgers by. We had a player by the name of Chris Steinmetz, who was an early All-American, did well in leading the team through the East, and is referred to as the father of Wisconsin basketball. Now, score-wise, we played one game against Beloit. It was 80-10. Now, some of the opposition, we played some National Guard teams in Sheboygan and Marinette, Manitowoc, and those games were closely contested, 29-28. In fact, the game against Sheboygan ended in a tie, 24-all. Well, they were supposed to play in overtime, but the Sheboygan team said they were too tired, so they left it at a tie. We said, well, for the forfeit, we'll take the game. So we wound up 26-24 as a win for the Badgers. Dr. Meanwhile, in one of his teams, I think it was 1914, in 1912, 13, and 14, we won 44 games and lost one. And the one defeat was the last game of the 1913 season, where Chicago beat us 23-10. Most of the games were low scoring, although there were the games that we mentioned earlier with Steinmetz. Some of those games were a little bit outrageous because of the lack of quality of competition by some of these schools. 1914, there was a 50-0 win for the Badgers over Parsons College, which probably a lot of people won't believe that, but that's what was reported. 1923, there was a triple overtime against DePaul University of Greencastle, Indiana, 25-25. It would have continued, but both coaches felt their squads were tired, and they called it a draw.
That's wonderful. A draw, boy. Could you see that happening today?
Yeah, first minute is sometimes you...
it's 25-25 after two minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how Rashad would have done in some of those games. The average size, what were these guys, about 5'11 or 6 feet?
Yeah, they weren't very big. Some of them weighed 160, 175 pounds, probably went 5'10", 5'11". And then eventually the big men, as we learned more about the body and what it takes to become coordinated, as we achieved that, the players kept developing, getting better and better. And of course, I know from personal visiting with Dr. Meanwell in 1945-46, I went to Wisconsin High School, and we played all of our home games in the field house. And this one year, his son Walter Jr. was a member of our basketball team, so Doc would come and watch practice, and he always told me that the way to shoot free throws was two-handed. You know, now they have the push shot. And I can imagine that he was the type of coach that you followed his instructions, or you might not play any more that one game, or maybe several games. But he was the advocate of a two-hand push shot, and shoot your free throws two-handed. Of course, they did that underhanded in those days. And so even up into the 1930s, you ask about results of games. We played our first game in 1934-35, would be the 35 Big Ten season. Mm-hmm. We played Northwestern, and it's hard to believe, but the score was 16-9. That was the first Big Ten game Bud Foster coached, and that team went on to win the share of the Big Ten title that year with Purdue and Illinois. Now, some of the games, I cite winning games, but I know one of the games near the end of that season, we played Purdue at Purdue, and we got beat 43-24. And you got to remember, at that time, until I think it was 37, 38, that's when they eliminated the center jump. Because in those days, you went back after each basket and you center jumped. And you might win six or seven center jumps in a row and allow your opponent to get way ahead of you, or you get way ahead of your opponent.
I didn't know they had center jumps after every basket.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, the underhand free throw, wasn't it Rick Barry in the NBA? He was the last of the...
Yeah.
And he had one of the highest percentages. Didn't he have like a 94% average or something?
I think you're right. And but that's the way it was done, and that's not so far removed.
I'll bet that we see a revival of that someday, because I've read that you can be tremendously accurate if you learn how to do it right.
Well, I think in free throw shooting, both the way the one-hand shot that they use today, you got to get yourself set, you got to take your time, and you watch the people that are very good at it. They do take their time, and they focus on the basket, and even though people are going crazy, waving towels and everything at you, they're able to make the free throw. But in 1947, one of the games that we won that was crucial to us winning the national, the Big Ten championship was at Michigan. And Exner Menzel was the forward opposite Bobby Cook. And he was fouled with 2 seconds left in the game. And the score is 51-50 Michigan. Well, Exner stepped up to the line and shooting his underhand free throws, he made them both, and we won the game 52-51. And of course, the ball was a little bit different in those days too. And some of those years, they played with a ball that was laced. And now the ball is just a round sphere, you might say.
Didn't the lace ball make it kind of difficult to dribble?
At times, yeah, yeah.
Let's turn for a moment to some of the coaches who have been associated with the UW in different sports. Let's start out with football. We certainly don't have to mention all of them, but some of the key coaches and a little bit about them.
All right. A lot of our early coaches came from the East. They were obviously the Ivy League was the forerunner of football in this country, and Rutgers and Princeton having played the first game in 1869, and then when the Badgers started signing up coaches, they didn't all stay very long. I think we had 92, 93, 94, 95. We had different coach each year. When 1896, Phil King came to the university to coach football. He was an All-American at Princeton. And he stayed 7 years, and he won 55 games, lost 9, and tied 2. He was succeeded by Art Curtis. Art Curtis had been the captain of the 1901 team. He was an and. And I think what we find here is that we felt that instead of going out east to pick up our coaches, we'd sort of have a graduate system where if a man was a graduate of our school and wanted to coach football, we'd try to work him into being our head football coach. Well, Art Curtis did this for his first year in 1903. It was 6-3-1. He felt he hadn't done a very good job, so he offered his resignation. But the students and the faculty felt otherwise, and so they renewed him for another year. Well, he was 5-3 in 1904, and that ended the hopes of having a graduate system of coaches. So the next person that he coached in three different times, John Richards in 1911, John Richards again in 1917, and then 1920, 21, 22. Yeah, he coached 5 or 6 years there, but at three different time spans. A good coach. He built the 1911 team into what would become our first real championship team in 1912, undefeated. And I say first real in that we didn't play all the teams in 1896 and in 1897. In fact, in 1896, our record was 2 wins, no defeats, 1 tie. You played 3 of the 7 teams in the league at the time, and this probably was due to travel problems or expenses. You couldn't do all of all that travel on the limited budgets that they had, and consequently, Richards was a standout, a winning coach. He was succeeded in 1912 by Bill Juneau, who also had played for the Badgers, and Juneau led us to an undefeated season, 7-0. We ran up some tremendous scores, beat Northwestern 56-0, beat Arkansas 64-7, beat Iowa 28-10, Minnesota. So Juneau, after 13, though, the chemistry wasn't there, and the Badgers went down, and he resigned. George Little, we mentioned earlier, he coached 2 years, but he was probably more interested in being the athletic director and overseeing not only the intercollegiate program but the intramural program as well. Glenn Thistlewaite came from Northwestern to coach at the end of the 20s, had a great team in 1928, should have won the Big Ten championship perhaps, got off to a good start beating Notre Dame in the Camp Randall 22-6. Knut Rockne complained afterwards, Notre Dame must have had a good, speedy team, because Rockne's complaint after the game was that we should have cut the grass because it was too long. We had a chance to win the Big Ten. If we'd beat Minnesota in the final game, we would be the champions of the Big Ten. But Minnesota and Bronco Nagurski prevailed 6-0. And that was something that was to happen to us several times, was Minnesota being the spoiler in our hopes for a Big Ten championship. After Thistlewaite came Doc Spears, Clarence Spears. He and Dr. Meanwell got into several brawls during their time here. Both men very aggressive, and both had much wanted success for their teams, Meanwell in basketball, Spears in football. Spears had a great team in 1932, and I think we missed it, not because of Minnesota, but I think we had a tie with Ohio State 7-7, and we lost to Purdue 7-6. We had an uncanny knack for missing those extra points against some of those teams. And then after the Spears-Meanwell situation was solved, they brought in Harry Stuhldreher from Villanova to be our coach, and he was our coach for 13 years and stayed on after he resigned in December of 48 to be our athletic director for 2 more years, and then he left to go with U.S. Steel in a public relations position. His leaving triggered Ivan Williamson coming to Madison from Lafayette College in Pennsylvania, and one of the people that he brought with him as assistant coach was Milt Bruhn, who had played on the Minnesota championship teams in the mid-30s. And our football in that span of 14 years, now Bruhn coached 11 and Williamson 7, but in a span of 14 years there, between 1949 and 1962, we had the second best record in the Big Ten for those 14 years, and I think the only school that had a better record during that time was Michigan. And then, of course, retired in 1966. We followed that with John Cota, who had been a star quarterback on our 1950-51 teams. John Jardine came from the West Coast in 1970 to be our coach for 7 years. Dave McLean came from Ball State, although he had played at Bowling Green collegially. And then, let's see, after McLean, when McLean died in April of 1986, Jim Hillis was named an interim coach. Don Morton then came to us from Tulsa for 3 years, and then Barry Alvarez from Notre Dame, where he was an assistant in 1990. So that gives you an idea of the men that have coached the Badgers. Left out, interestingly enough, in the early days, Art Curtis, when he may have had an ulterior motive to get out of coaching in that he was a medical student, wanted to get his doctor's degree. We had two other doctors at Withington. Dr. Withington was one of them. And John Richards, interestingly enough, one of the years when we asked him to come back, he came back, but at the time he was a director of the parks in Chicago. So he would only come back the 1st of September and coach during the season. The rest of the time he wasn't in residence.
He was down tending the parks. Wasn't Stuhl Dreher one of the four horsemen?
Yes, he was.
Could you just put that on, put that in a sentence?
Harry Stuhl Dreher had quite a career at Notre Dame. He was the quarterback of the four horsemen. And we played that team at Madison in 1924. And they beat us 38-3. And also then they went on to play Stanford in the Rose Bowl. And they beat Stanford rather handily, although I have a feeling from reading accounts of the game that Stanford was the pregame favorite. And one of the reasons was they had a football player from Superior, Wisconsin, by the name of Ernie Nevers. And Nevers played outstanding football for Stanford that day as well, but Notre Dame had too much offensive strength and beat him 27-10. Now Nevers, a little bit later, playing professionally, set the National Football League record for points in a game at 40, playing for the Chicago Cardinals.
I didn't know Nevers was from Superior, Wisconsin. He was one of the great college players.
Great.
Let's go to basketball for a moment, and if you could talk about some of the coaches there, as we did with football.
All right. Starting right at the beginning, a group of young men came to Wisconsin from Milwaukee, and Milwaukee South High School, and one of them was Walter Hirschberg, and he was the person that took charge of the other four people, you might say, and formed the first basketball team, and he was a coach and captain, and then basketball really took off, though, when Emmett Angell came to the Wisconsin in the Phi Ed department. And we did win a couple of championships. We didn't start playing basketball in the Big Ten until 1906. And even though the league was formed in 1896, basketball didn't become a sport until 1906 in the conference. And I think 1906, Minnesota won the first championship. They were 6-1, we were 6-2. Sometimes games were postponed and maybe not made up, and that accounted for some of the irregularities in the standings. And I think 1907 we won, and 1908 we tied with Chicago for the championship. And there was a playoff game played in 1908 between Wisconsin and Chicago, and it was played here at Madison in the Armory, and we got beat 18-16. So they played 40 minutes and got 34 points. It's good defense on both teams. Dr. Meanwell came from out east in 1911 and in time to take charge of the 1911-1912 team, and he basically had a short pass. A weave type offense involving, you might say, fancy footwork, a lot of footwork to it because you were weaving and passing the short pass. And the object was to get a layup at the end of the court when you got down to the end opponent's basket. He was very successful. After 1916, 1912, 13, 14 teams, as They won 44 games and lost one. They played a 15-game schedule. They could play 12 conference games, and the league, the conference ruled that they could play just three outside games. A little bit later, they still played 12 games, but they could play five outside games. It kept getting progressively to the point where you played more and more games. And in the year when Dr. Meanwell left Wisconsin in 1917 to come back in 1920, the person that was our coach was Guy Lohman. Now, Guy Lohman coached football in 1918. He also was a basketball coach, and his main love, however, was baseball. So he, not a showman. He just did these things. You might say he was Wisconsin's first man for all seasons, but he was out there and accomplished a Big Ten title in basketball in 1918. And also in 1918, he took the football team to Columbus, Ohio. And we beat Ohio State at that time in 1918, 14-3. Now, we weren't going to win another game at Columbus in football until 1982. So there were 64 years between victories at Columbus, and we had never won in the Ohio Stadium, which was built in 1922 and opened, and it was built to open in 1922. And in 1982, we won for the first time in that stadium. So Lohman's remembered for a number of reasons: a Big Ten basketball championship, his game against Ohio State that they won 14-3. And incidentally, on that 1918 team, there was a freshman by the name of Frederick Smith from Freeport, Illinois. And as the years went by, you can imagine that Fred Smith, his memories were such that, well, we played in a winning game at Ohio in 1918, and here it was. We'd start getting letters from him just about every year when we're going to go back to play at Ohio State. He would remind us that he had played on that last team that won. So it was almost like he said, "Well, I won there. Now let's see if you people can win there." So, well, we did have better luck at Columbus. We won in 82, and then we went back in 85 and beat them 12-7 there. So it's been great to see that. Well, then Dr. Meanwell came back and coached until the end of the 33-34 season. I would say his most outstanding team was his 1923 team, this being in the second part of his tenure at Wisconsin. The three teams that he put together right at the beginning, 12, 13, 14, were the outstanding teams of that era. But the 1923 team played a 12-game schedule, won 11 and lost one, tied with Iowa 11-1 for the title. In the 12 games, gave up 198 points. Unbelievable. And of course, the scores, as you can imagine, were low-scoring games, but with the emphasis on defense. And for his career then, he won 246 games and lost 99.
Well, wasn't he known as the father of basketball? I mean, not only, he was a high-visibility national figure.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And many teams followed his, many coaches would come to the clinics, and he would teach them his style of basketball. And he had come to, Mr. Meanwell was, Doc Meanwell was born in Leeds, England, and came to this country as a youngster. And his job before he came to Madison was in charge of the gym program at a YMCA in Baltimore, I believe. And he just developed this style of basketball, and may well have been in the YMCA in Baltimore, but when he got out here, he wowed everybody with it. And of course, it made Wisconsin an early power in the sport of basketball. Now, a person that had played under Meanwell and probably his tallest player at the time was Bud Foster. And Bud had come to the University from Mason City, Iowa, and And he was to lead us to Big Ten championships in 35, 41, and 47. The 41 team opened its Big Ten season losing at Minnesota 46-27. And then they came back and righted themselves and went on to win 15 straight games. 11 games in the conference. And late in the season, they played the crucial game against Indiana at Bloomington. Indiana had won the Big Ten in 1940 and had won the NCAA championship in 1940. So we were going down to Bloomington and play them on their home court. And with Gene England and John Kotz, Chuck Epperson, Fred Ream, Ed Shiway, we beat them 38-30. And then we closed out the season with a win. We had some close calls. We played a couple overtime games, one against Purdue, one against Northwestern, and but survived. We hosted then the NCAA Eastern Regional, which involved Wisconsin, Dartmouth, Pittsburgh, and North Carolina. And let's see, I think we beat Pittsburgh for the right to move on to the championship game in Kansas City from the West Regional. There are only eight teams picked for that year. And our opponent was going to be Washington State, who had defeated Arkansas in the Western Championship game. So we, Bud had a great scout in Fred Wagner. Fritz was his assistant coach, and what he did was he sent Fritz on a scouting mission to see what Washington State had, or Arkansas. And so when we prevailed over Pittsburgh to win the Eastern Regional, getting ready for Washington State, we had a scouting report. We knew what they could do, what the abilities of the players were, and when we got to Kansas City, we were well prepared, and we beat Washington State 39-34. And that, again, emphasizes the type of game that the Wisconsin played, low scoring, a lot of defense. And then Bud coached through the 58-59 season and was replaced by John Erickson, who had coached at, who had played at Beloit College, coached at Stevens Point P.J. Jacobs High School. And then after seeing service in the military, he coached at Lake Forest, and he'd come to Wisconsin as an assistant coach in the previous season in, 58-59. So he was on board, and he was named the next coach, and then he left to become the first general manager of the Milwaukee Bucks back in 68. Succeeded by John Paulus. Paulus had interviewed for the job along with Dave Brown, who were both the Erickson assistants, but there were also some outsiders that were interviewed, including Bobby Knight. And Bobby Knight, it was everybody's feeling that when he left Madison, the job was his and he had taken it. It wasn't to be the case, however, because on Friday he informed he had gone back on his way back to he was the coach at West Point at the time, and on the way back he had stopped to see his old mentor Fred Taylor at Columbus, and then got back to West Point. And it was at that point on Friday that he called Ivy Williamson and informed him that he was not going to take the job, although it had hit the papers a couple days before that he had accepted the job. And so John Paulus also was our tennis coach. And we had home baseball, and Ivan, this is how I got involved in it. Ivan called me away from the baseball and said that there was going to be a meeting at approximately 5 o'clock in the law school in Professor Remington's office, and that he needed to have John Paulus there. So that was the meeting that John had to leave his tennis team. They ended up winning, and so That was how that happened. And John Paulus coached until through 76 season, and Bill Cofield came on board and coached till 83, and then Steve Yoder and Stu Jackson, now Van Gundy. And I think in the last 30 years, I think the game that most everybody remembers is the one that John Erickson coached against Ohio State in 1962 on March 3rd. And we beat Ohio State 86-67. Lucas was the star of the team. Jerry Lucas, John Havlicek, Mel Knoll, those are the three. They filled in with other players at the other two spots, but they were a good basketball team. That was their first loss in, I think, 47 games in the Big Ten. And they were ranked number one. And I'm sure that they're probably, you know, the attendance at that game was 13,545. You can imagine that people were really crammed in there. But I'll bet if you were to walk down the street and visit with people who might have seen the game, maybe people in the age bracket of 50 to 60 now, you probably get about 200,000 people that said they were there.
Well, I can truthfully say I remember sitting on the floor, I was a kid in Milwaukee, watching that game on television.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
There was a Knight who played for Ohio State.
Bobby Knight.
Was that Bobby Knight?
Yes.
That was Bobby Knight.
Yeah, and there was a Richter that played for Wisconsin.
And that was
Pat, yeah.
I guess I'd forgotten that they were the same Knights. Let's take about a 5-minute break here, stretch our legs, and give me a chance to see exactly where we are.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the coaches and the baseball program.
All right, the baseball program, we mentioned Guy Lohman. He coached until the late 20s, and then through the 30s, there were several coaches. Fuzzy Douglas was one of them, and starting in 1940, the coach was Diney Mansfield. Now, Diney had been a boxing champion of Wisconsin, not intercollegiately, but we used to have all university bouts in the 20s, and he was a heavyweight, and he got his nickname Diney from his knockout punch. They called him Dynamite. So he coached until 1971, then Tom Meyer took over. And then in 82, Tom left, and Steve Land was our coach from that point on until we dropped the sport in 1991. And Mansfield had two teams that were outstanding, his 46 team and the 1950 team. The 1950 team, the 1950 team played Michigan here in a doubleheader at Guy Lohman Field, and they won both games and proceeded to go to the NCAA championships in Omaha, and won two games and lost two games, a double elimination. I think we finished up fourth. Had a star pitcher, Thornton Kipper, on that team, won 11 games and lost one. Had a fair career in pro baseball, with the Phillies, and of course the Phillies in those days were coming off a championship in 1950, and had some star pitchers like Kurt Simmons and Robin Roberts, and I think if it had been another era, Kipper might have caught on and really excelled. He was an excellent pitcher. Probably his best, Diney always said his best player was Howie Basie, who was a center fielder on the 46 team. Although he did have the playing abilities of Harvey Keene on his in the years immediately following the championship team. Harvey had started his career out in Iowa and transferred back to Wisconsin, where he played both basketball and baseball. And led the league in triples 1 year with 9, and batted over 400. And Ron Niemann was a star outfielder on our 58 team and All-American as well. And then in the early 60s, Pat Richter and Rick Reichert were the two outstanding players. Richter helped us in 1962. We swept Michigan here to deprive them of the Big Ten championship. And the ace, Richter was a star of the second game that knocked Michigan out of the championship when he hit a home run off Fritz Fischer, Michigan's star pitcher, a left-hander. And the ball was still rising when it went over the center field fence. It was hit on a line. It was just one of those that rose up and kept going. And ironically, even though Michigan wasn't the Big Ten champion, they got to play in the NCAA. They took both teams, Illinois and Michigan. Michigan won the NCAA title and then went to play the Japan All-Stars in a tour of that country at the end. And then the next year, 63 and 64, Rick Reichert was the star player. He led the league in hitting both 63 and 64 and hit with power. And up until, I think, 2 years ago, his record was tied. There was a player from Indiana that repeated as batting champion. But those are the only two cases where a batting champion has repeated. And let's see, pitching-wise, we had some good pitchers. George Schmid, probably one of them. Ron Crone, another, played on the 62 team. George Schmid back in the 57-58. And it's about it for baseball.
Okay. I have Thornton Kiffer's baseball card in my
cardboard
box. Yeah.
Oh, great.
I thought he played for the Cubs for a while, too. It seems to me I remember seeing a Cub up in the corner, but maybe it wasn't. I'll have to check it back.
Were the Cubs laying down?
I'll check. Okay, before we get to some, Schreiner and some of these other wonderful people who have played in sports, give us a thumbnail sketch of boxing. I don't think people today can understand. I've interviewed a lot of alums who would go to those boxing matches. They cannot begin to understand how popular boxing was here and how it filled the field house and what an incredible experience it was to be at a boxing match. Could you just give us a little background on boxing?
All right. The father of Wisconsin boxing is George Downer. George Downer, at the time in 1932-33, was the athletic publicity director, or the sports information director, as they're called now. And he took a great interest in boxing, and of course there were, in the 20s, all the all-university bouts that were held, I think from about 1920 through 29 or 30. And he thought that boxing was a commodity that you could sell to the public. And he arranged in 1933 for St. Thomas College of Minnesota to come down and box the Badgers lineup. And as luck would have it, one of the competitors for St. Thomas was John Walsh, who impressed George quite a bit. And George arranged for John to transfer from St. Thomas. He wanted to be a lawyer. And so John came down to Wisconsin, and while he was a law student, he also was the coach of the boxing. And it's a sport, the start of the sport of boxing parallels the start of the sport of hockey in the 60s here at Wisconsin. And before you knew it, Wisconsin was winning a whole flock, putting together undefeated seasons, one right after the other. And the 1935 team was the first undefeated team, and there was no NCAA meet at that time. But I think they were 7-0, or they might have been 8-0, they declared themselves the mythical champions of the United States. And so you'll see in the field house, there's nine banners, boxing championships, and there's a 10th one for basketball, which the boxing people purchased, had made, and put up in the field house. And our first NCAA champion was Bobby Fadner in 1936 at 125 pounds. And every 4 years at those times, they had boxing trials. The colleges would try out for the Olympics. And we do have the records in 32, 36 that to go on. And you could add up and determine, like, maybe West Virginia had two or three champions, and they... You score the meet based on the information you have. Well, getting back to Wisconsin, 1939, we hosted for the first time the NCAA championship meet. And, of course, it did a tremendous amount of... We won the title, and the crowds were exceptional. And a very interesting story, 1939 was also the first time that the NCAA had a basketball tournament. Now, the basketball tournament in 1939 was sponsored by the Basketball Coaches Association, College Basketball Coaches Association, and it was held at Evanston, Illinois. And they didn't quite make all their expenses, but the boxing, the NCAA stepped in to become the father, you might say, of the basketball tournament at that time. And it was a boxing NCAA championship here in Madison. Well, some of the monies that were used, that were profit from the boxing here in Madison, were used to help the basketball coaches pay their bills so they could put on the next tournament. And Bud Foster, I talked to him several times about that, and that's a really what did happen. Then we had some crowd pleasers in boxing. Omar Crocker, who a lot of people say is the best boxer we ever had. Woody Swancutt. Gene Rankin. Gene Rankin died recently. All three are deceased now. Warren Jolly Moore was another outstanding boxer in these days. And in 42 and 43, we won back-to-back titles, and the 43 team had five individual champions. Then there was no NCAA boxing during the war, although we did continue to have... boxing on an intercollegiate basis, although most of our opponents were service teams like Ottumwa, Iowa, and the Iowa Seahawks. And Coach Walsh was in the service for 1945, so they brought in DeWitt Portell from the West Coast to be our boxing coach, and then John came back late in 45 and was co-coach with Portell in 46, but he took over, and we won in 47 and 48. And then after that, we won in 52 and 54 and 56. So that added up to 8 championships. We had 32 boxers that were national champions. They won a total of 38 titles. And the thing that... we should have won the title in 1960, but a very unfortunate thing happened. Charlie Moore, who was a senior, 165-pounder from out in Merrick, New York, was injured in the ring fatally when he was hit by a punch by Stu Bartel of San Jose State. And a week later, on Easter Sunday of 1960, Charlie passed on. He couldn't overcome the injury. And... Within a month, boxing had been dropped as a college sport, even though a lot of people, it was the most ironic thing, Charlie Moore losing his life in the ring, because they wore helmets, protective helmets, and some of the competitors, there was a competitor, as I recall, from Marquette, which didn't have boxing, but he wanted to box in the national tournament. Those boxers from Stanford and Chico State were of the intramural variety in that they, if you had boxed before enrolling at these schools, you were ineligible for boxing. So the people that were boxing for them were really rank amateurs. And here they are coming to Madison for the national tournament, and they didn't get hurt. Charlie Moore lost his life in that tournament. That was really, I've always thought that was ironic. Well, that took, we had a great record in boxing. It was outstanding. I think the last time I figured it up, we had something like 73 home wins, one or two defeats at home, and several ties. Just an outstanding program. Well, after boxing was dropped, the athletic board, under the guidance of Ivy Williamson, our athletic director, and hockey was beginning to make itself felt in the Madison area, and out on the east side, Hartmeyer Arena was finally covered over, had a roof on it. Kenton Felsey was a great advocate of hockey. And so in 1962-63, we had our first team, but they just practiced. And then a week after President Kennedy was assassinated in November of 1963, we played our first college hockey games of the new era. We had played hockey back in from 1914 to 1933 or 34, but in the new era, our first games were against St. Mary's of Minnesota. St. Mary's scored the first 12 goals against us in the first game. We got a goal on a shot on goal by Tom French, and we lost the game 13-6. And the next night we got beat 12-2. So that was an inauspicious start. I mean, not like what I said about boxing and how they came out. But the next week we played McAllister College and we won the first game in overtime. And we went on to play a schedule that included Carleton College and Western Michigan, University of Illinois Hockey Club. And we won 8 and lost 5 and tied 2 under the guidance of Art Thompson and John Riley. Riley had been an outstanding amateur player here in town, and he was a lawyer. Son Mike also played for us. Art Thompson had been associated with the hockey program back in the 30s and was in the intramurals here at the university at that time. So they were co-coaches, and they coached Art and John 1 year together, and then John the next 2 years. And then John informed Ivy that he was going to stick to his law practice. So the search for a coach led to Bob Johnson out at Colorado College. And Bob had been here several times talking to Blue Line clubs, so he was known in Madison among the hockey fans. A very a gregarious person, a very optimistic person, always positive about the game of hockey. And so he was hired as our coach, and as you know, it took off. We had our first national championship in 1973, and he repeated in 77 and 81. In between, there were times when we went to the national tournament and we didn't win it, but he opted eventually, and at the end of 1982, to go to the professional rank and started out with the Calgary Flames. And he was succeeded by Jeff Sauer, who was the coach then at that time at Colorado College. And Jeff had played for Bob in 1964-65. And in fact, they broadcast the games back. Colorado College was playing here at Hartmeyer against us, and they wanted information. So what we did, we had two students, Chuck Nason was one of them, and we put them up in a higher, there was a, oh, what would you call it, platform up above the entrance to Hartmeyer Ice Arena. We put them up there with a Western Union man, and they dictated to the Western Union man what they wanted so that the guy back in Colorado College could recreate it, just like they did the baseball games back in the 30s and 40s. And that was the first broadcast from Hartmeyer Ice Arena. We've come a long way since then. But and I mentioned that to Jeff one day, and he remembered that, what had happened. They did it both nights, and they had their own version of, you know, right wing. A lot of words weren't spelled out, but because the hockey announcer back at Colorado College knew what their system was, he was able to recreate the game at the same time it was being played here.
Didn't you do that in football at the Red Gym at the Armory sometimes with that griddograph? Wasn't that kind of...
Oh, yeah, back in the early 20s.
Early
20s, yeah.
I remember seeing pictures of the cheerleader guy mm-hmm. that pushed the thing forward. In the time that's remaining, we've as I mentioned during the break, we've hit on some of the key people, athletes I'm talking about now. But let's talk about some of the others. David Schreiner, Elroy Hirsch. Maybe you could just start out by talking about some of the key football people, and then we could just go through the sports like we have.
Okay. in football, in the 1942 football team, which won 8 games, lost one, tied one, we had an All-American end by the name of Dave Schreiner. He had also been All-American in 1941. Just an outstanding pass receiver. He led us in pass catches. He was from Lancaster, Wisconsin. Nobody ran his end. They couldn't. He was one of the outstanding ends of his time, and as I mentioned, a good pass catcher. And I think it was in the Marquette game of 1942, he had 3 touchdown passes against Marquette, and we beat him 35-7. Another player on that team that I just want to associate him with, Schreiner, is Bob Bauman, an outstanding tackle from Harvey, Illinois. Both of those men were Marine lieutenants at the time they were killed on Okinawa, just before the battle for Okinawa ended. And it was a very sad thing that happened. Sophomore running back on that team was from Wausau, Wisconsin, Elroy Hirsch. Got his nickname Crazy Legs as a sophomore when he played down at we played a game in Soldier Field. Great Lakes, 13-7. Jack Wink ran back of interception, 101 yards. It's 101 yards in one paper. It's 103 yards in another source. 105 yards in another. But Hirsch was a sophomore running back, and he had a funny gait, and one of the sports writers in that game saw him make a long run, which I think was 63 yards, and called him Crazy Legs, and it stuck. we won our first 5 games. Well, we won 4 of our first 5 games that year. We tied Notre Dame 7-7. We defeated Camp Grant 7-0 in the first game. Beat Missouri 17-9 in a game that Bob Stuber was the star for Missouri, and Don Farrow, who is still living in Columbia, Missouri in his 90s now, was a coach. It was a great game. Elroy Hirsch ran for 174 yards that day on 22 carries. And you got to remember that these players played all the way. There was no free substitution. There were certain substitution rules that you could, but most of these games in 1942, you look and there's maybe 16, 17 players. And in a couple of games, there were probably 11 or 12, 13 players. And came to the, our first Big Ten game then was against Purdue at their homecoming, beat them 13-0. Came home for our homecoming game against Ohio State, which we won 17-7. 10-7 score late in the game, and we ran a play where Hirsch faded to his right, and Schreiner slipped out to the left, and in the corner of the end zone, they call it Transamerica pass, it went that way, and Schreiner caught it, and then we won 17-7. The next week, we go to Iowa, and we must have been, you know, you're high for a game like Ohio State, and Iowa got high for us because they beat us 6-0, spoiled a potential national championship team's record. That shocked the Badgers. They went down to Northwestern to play 19-14 with about 30 seconds to play in the game in favor of Northwestern, and we came through with a winning touchdown. Seelinger threw the ball, Len Seelinger, he was from Montana, and I believe it was Mark Hoskins, who was from Shriner's hometown of Lancaster, that caught the ball for the winning score, 20-19. Otto Graham was the quarterback that day for Northwestern. Then we came home and we hadn't beat Minnesota, let's see, since 1932. And we got off right away, struck with a pass to Schreiner that set us up in scoring position. We went on to win 20-6. Unfortunately, Ohio State, after they played us, for their only loss, they played one more Big Ten game than we did. They were 5-1, we were 4-1. And they were the Big Ten champions, and they also were the national champions. Georgia with Frankie Sinkiewicz was the number two team that year. We were ranked third.
What happened to, I guess we can...
All right, well, that's an interesting story. This happened, Illinois and Wisconsin were supposed to get the Marine Reserve. And so Harry Stuhldreher, as I understand, was told to enroll all your players that you want or that are eligible in the Marine program. Same thing happened in Illinois, except that a little bit later, after this had all been accomplished, the orders were changed. The Marines went to Michigan from Wisconsin, and the Marines went from Illinois to Purdue. So Purdue and Michigan end up in 43, sharing the Big Ten title 6-0. Wisconsin and Illinois were down the pack, obviously, in 43. We got the V-12 program, Navy radio, and so those were the people that came to, and they played football. They came out and they played hard, but we didn't have half the talent that we had in 42. And our only win in 1943 was we beat Iowa 7-5. We scored a touchdown, they scored a field goal and safety, and that was it. We took some poundings. We lost to Purdue, I think 34-0. Notre Dame beat us 50-0. Northwestern beat us 41-0. We had a string there going. I think we lost even to Indiana about 30-0. So, but it was interesting football, but you just knew that when the war was over, these people would come back and we'd be all set. But in 1945, in October of 1945, we got word that Elroy Hirsch had signed with the Chicago Rockets of the fledgling AFL, or All-America Football Conference, what it was, with the Chicago Rockets and later the Chicago Hornets. And eventually, when that league disbanded, he was picked up by the drafted or signed as a free agent with the Los Angeles Rams, and he played there 8 years and played well enough that he was named, he's been in just about every Hall of Fame, and was named to the all-time NFL team in the first 50 years as the outstanding receiver, wide receiver. And the way the Rams used he and Tom Fears, that was the forerunners of the wideouts that you see in the game today. Earl Gerard was an All-American in 1944 as their quarterback. He ran out of the Notre Dame box, but he was Bill Stern came to broadcast the Wisconsin-Ohio State game in 1944. And we lost the game 20-7, but we gave him quite a battle. And Les Horvath was the star running back for Ohio State, and he went on to win the Heisman Trophy that year. And he was only 175 pounds. we mentioned earlier John Kotz and Gene England. Kotz came from Rhinelander, Wisconsin, and had a push shot, a one-hand push shot, where he'd fake one way and come back and shoot the other. And good score. And set the Big Ten scoring record, 242 points in 15 games in 1942, the year following the NCAA championship. But down at Illinois, at the same time, for 42-43, they developed the Whiz Kids, Andy Phillip, Ken Mankey, Jack Smiley, Gene Vance. They were all sophomores. And Phillip, in 12 games in 1943, broke Kotz's record of 242 with 255. And they had two junior centers. One was Wukowicz, the other was Art Mathiesen. And they should have probably won the national championship in 43, but they didn't. The war then came along, and the first game of the Big Ten season, 47, this was the year we were going to win it. We played the Whiz Kids back from service in the field house, and we lucked out. We'd be in 52-47. It was a tremendous game. Then we went down to Iowa, and we had a big lead. I think it was 62-41. We won 63-62. And then our third game was against Indiana here in the field house, and they had a star from their prior to the war, Ralph Hamilton, back with them, and we beat them 70-49. And the key of that team was the unselfish play of Exner Menzel. He was the forward that, in this Foster system that we had, he would feed the ball to Bobby Cook. The ball, it'd be several passes, and Cook would end up with the ball for a pot shot, you might say, 5-6 feet from the basket. Our guards were Walt Lautenbach and Glenn Selbo. Most tremendous finish to a game I ever saw was against Northwestern that year here at the field house. It's 44-41, and Lautenbach shoots from outside, scores. 44-43, Big Ed Mills, I think it was Mills, he's guarding out-of-bounds pass. We intercept it, threw the ball up, rolled back, and I think the tip was by Lautenbach himself again, and we win the game 45-44. And I tell you, people were so excited. About 10 minutes after the game, they were still standing and cheering. It was an unbelievable finish. But those are the kind of things you need in the year that you're going to win a championship. And I mentioned to you what happened at Michigan with Menzel making two free throws with no time left. And boxing, we mentioned Crocker and Swancutt, Gene Rankin, three national titles. He's one of two or three boxers nationally that won three national championships. And, of course, in the 50s, I should say one guy, I think Chuck Davey, won four for Michigan State. He later boxed against Kid Gavilan. Michigan State. We've gone over baseball players.
What about Crew? Were there any we talked about?
Well, baseball. Crew has a long history at Wisconsin, but to start in 1946, they rode in the Eastern Sprint Regatta out in the Potomac River, and they won it. And these guys have Dick Tipple from Madison, Dick Miller from Milwaukee. Dick went to high school at Wisconsin High. Carl Holtz was a stroke on that team and that boat. Carlisle Fay, I think, was the coxswain. Gordy Grimstead. Just a tremendous effort, and that put us back in good stead. We went on then 4 years later, 5 years later, to win our first regatta. It always used to be held on the Hudson River at Poughkeepsie. And we had several close calls. We should have won several times. One of them was in 1899, when our crew ran into a berry crate floating around in the course. And we had to deviate and went several yards out of our way, and we lost by 5 feet. And but then that was under Coach Norm Sanyu, coached that 51 crew, which happened down at Marietta on the Ohio River, because they got, Poughkeepsie just got too crowded with all the boats around. So, and then our 59 crew won after Marietta, everything, Marietta in 51, 52, and then everything went to Syracuse on Lake Onondaga. And then it was there in 59 we won the three-mile race, which was the last three-mile race they had, because after that they went to Olympic distances, not only in the Olympic year, but every year, which is meter race. Getting all tied up here. But the coach, one of the competitors on the 59 crew was Randy Jablonik. And Jablonik became our freshman coach after he completed his competition. And when Norm Sanju left, retired in 1968, Randy became the crew coach, and he's been there ever since. And, of course, in the early 70s, 73, 74, 75, he won three straight national titles in a row. And he's won the 10 Ike trophies 8 or 9 times, which is taking all the events that you roll and scoring it like a track meet. And he's done an excellent job.
I'm going to wrap it up with one more person, because I hope to get this person in here, and maybe this can serve as an introduction to him. Could you tell us a little bit about Pat Richter's career on the field and where he is today?
All right, Pat Richter played football and basketball and baseball at Madison East High School. His dad had been a star for East High back in the mid-30s. Pat was a junior on the Madison East High School basketball team that won the state championship in 1958. That team had Ron Staley, who came to Wisconsin to play football. Dave Heisig, Richter was the center, Bob Powers and Dale Holshuter were the guards. And they won the state championship, beating Milwaukee North in the championship game. They got way ahead. They really came out psyched up. And the center for Milwaukee North was Howard Fuller, who's the superintendent of schools now for Milwaukee. And he came to Wisconsin on a basketball scholarship given by John Erickson. And I think it was possible that Pat could, John said, "You're sure you can go out for football." He did. He was a leading pass receiver. The first game he played against Stanford as a sophomore, he caught 7 passes, which was the school record, broke the school record of 6. In the Michigan game, caught a long pass, 36 yards from Ron Miller, and when he got tackled, he broke his collarbone. So that ended his sophomore season. Got back in time to play basketball, missed the first 3 or 4 games, but he played first game at Bradley and played as a reserve. Then he was out for baseball. Played, as I recall, he was a right fielder all the time, but some people say he played first base, which he may have. then let's see, junior year, had a great junior year. And I think he caught 47 passes, 817 yards, 7 or 8 touchdowns, I think it was 7. And got a lot of attention from the media. He was an All-American. Played basketball. Went out to New York. And I swear this is where he made his mark. He played, came in a reserve role against Providence, which had John Thompson, the Georgetown coach now. Richter outscored him 14-10. And then the next night against Dayton, We beat Dayton, but I don't think Pat scored more than a basket. But we won. We really surprised everybody in New York in this Madison Square Garden holiday tournament. Played the championship game against Cincinnati, and we should have probably not played it. We got beat by 30 points. But this was a Cincinnati team that was at the time dueling with Ohio State for the national championship. And Cincinnati did win it. And then they played baseball again. And then came back for his senior year. And his senior year was a good year. Not as good as his junior year as far as statistics, but you got to remember he's probably getting double covered. And the one game that we lost in 1962 was to Ohio State at Ohio State, 14-7. And gosh, they put the player that was the his name escapes me right now, but he was a great offensive player for the Cleveland Browns. But at Ohio State, he played defense, and he defensed Richter this day. And then he had his great Rose Bowl game where he caught 11 passes for 167 yards and one touchdown. And then even though he started late in basketball because of the playing in the bowl game, he played enough to win. Had a good game against Michigan State. Over there we won in overtime, 92-89. I think he got 6 or 7 points when it really counted for us. And then played baseball again. And capped his baseball. Well, the most exciting moment for me was when he hit the line drive home run off Michigan's pitcher Fisher. But he's also credited with hitting a ball against Minnesota that landed, we're playing in the old Guy Lohman, and landed down in the lake. And he must have hit it about 500 feet. It really was a smash. So those are some of the highlights of his career. Got drafted first by the Redskins. Played with them through 70. So one of the years he played under Vince Lombardi. Got his law degree from Wisconsin, and then when he got done with that, of course he went with Oscar Mayer. That was his corporate career, and then 5 years ago he was named athletic director. So he's quite a success.
Any questions from up there?
Not for me, it sounds good.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Do you have anything that you want to say in closing? Any comments about the overview or Wisconsin athletics in general?
Well, I think we've got a great tradition of athletics. Some of the things we talked about today eliminated us talking about other things that we might well talk about. For instance, cross country, swimming, the other non-revenue sports we haven't really touched. And I suspect maybe in another time we could get together and visit on those things as well.
Okay. Yeah, I know. I felt guilty. We have wrestling. I mean, maybe we discuss with Ralph.